This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Carol Tangeman. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear about how a recent state grant will help the San Luis Obispo County Fire Safe Council.
That's our purpose, figure out a way to best cohabitate on the land with fire and then make the consequences reduced so people's homes aren't destroyed, their lives aren't destroyed, and the environment is protected.
And we'll hear the latest news from the Central Coast's Hourglass Project.
We unveiled our Reach 2030 plan, and within that we have a goal of creating 15,000 new good-paying jobs across the Central Coast.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, March 16th, 2020. I'm Carol Tangeman. The novel coronavirus global pandemic continues to dominate the news today, with the situation rapidly evolving and new closures announced by the hour. On Sunday afternoon, California Governor Gavin Newsom announced new confinement measures directing all residents aged 65 and older and chronically ill people to stay home and self-isolate. All bars, nightclubs, wineries, and brew pubs to close for the time being in an effort to contain community transmission of the virus. Restaurants across the Central Coast can stay open, but state officials are telling restaurant operators to reduce their capacity by 50% and seat patrons in such a way to provide a 6-foot buffer. All Central Coast public schools are closed as of today, and almost all public and private institutions have closed their doors. We're living in a whole new reality, with normal daily life interrupted in a way we've not seen. KCBX will keep you up to date on the latest news. But in the meantime, we're going to continue with our weekly news magazine show, Issues and Ideas. First up, CAL FIRE has awarded just under $2 million to the San Luis Obispo Fire Safe Council. The grant money will be used to help reduce the risk of wildfires in our communities. We're going to hear from Fire Safe Council Manager Dan Turner and Board Member Turco Sems. They've been searching for and acquiring grants for the local nonprofit with a mission to educate, organize, and do the actual work of preparing for wildfire on the Central Coast. So the Fire Safe Council, how did the whole thing come about?
So in 1993, a statewide Fire Safe Council was created. It is a separate entity from the County Fire Safe Council. So we have no direct relationship. There's no reporting relationship, but it was the foundation of an idea. That idea has then spawned itself all across California. There are dozens of Fire Safe Councils across the state. The San Luis Obispo County Fire Safe Council was founded in 1999. And the purpose of this one was to engage a cross-section of the stakeholders and then do something about it. So what we try to do is determine what's the obstacle in way of getting something done. So sometimes it's education. People don't realize there's a problem, so we educate them about the problem. And once they know about it, they do something about it. So fire's a natural part of this landscape. It burns. That's natural. It's not to be unexpected, but the consequences of those fires are what we don't like today. We've civilized, if you will, the land. So we have to figure out a way, how do we cohabitate with fire on this landscape? And so that's our purpose, figure out a way to best cohabitate on the land with fire and then make the consequences reduced so people's homes aren't destroyed, their lives aren't destroyed, and the environment is protected along that way.
Turco? Well, I think that we give information in lots of different forms, and the forms are some handouts. There are talks that are given, but also besides education, that's one small part of it. A lot of it is we get things done. We actually are doing fire prevention, creating swaths of area that has been cleared and continues to be cleared around different areas. So we can set this up ahead of time, sort of proactively plan for a fire that will come from whatever reason it may come. It'll come, and we can help minimize the impact. One of the great things I know I'm really proud of that has been amazing is mapping. The county now, every bit of it has been mapped with details of gates and water storage and tanks and addresses, and that's digitized so that if a firefighter comes from anywhere, they can have this downloaded onto their iPad, and they know exactly where they are, they're located, exactly what's available in their egress and how they can get out of things and where the water is.
Yeah, that mapping sounds amazing because I imagine when you're in a fire, it would be very disorienting.
Particularly if you've never been to the area before in your life, which is frequently the case in large fires, is we pull firefighters in from all kinds of areas. They may have never been here before. Put yourself, typically they arrive the first afternoon or evening, so they arrive in the dark. They've never been here before. They have no idea really what the road network is like. Put yourself in the middle of the west side of Atascadero or in Cambria on the road networks that are there at night with a fire. You get lost in there during the daytime, let alone at night with maybe a little bit of tension. So the purpose of this is to give them every opportunity to succeed. We've used these maps as a partnership with Cal Poly students. We use Cal Poly Geographic Information students to help us prepare these, so it's a great learning experience for them. And then the firefighters come, everyone that's come and used these maps go, oh my gosh, this is all the information I would have loved to have had on every other fire I went to. So that's the theory. Give them as much information as you can intuitively so they have it to refer to, and you're all working literally off the same page when you do these fires.
This is Issues and Ideas. I'm Carol Tangeman, and in the studio with me is Dan Turner, manager of the Fire Safe Council, and Turco Sems, who is on the board. And Dan, you were going to mention some of the other proactive ways that that the Fire Safe Council is helping keep the community safe.
So through grants, we identify projects, go apply for grants for those, and then we're able to assist those landowners, those communities, to actually take care of that problem. And our mission is to try to get them past that initial hurdle, and then they get it into a maintenance mode, so they take over from there. Because okay. We don't want to be permanent stewards of their process. So on March 10th, we were awarded $1.9 million in grant funds to carry out 17 projects across this county that are fuel reduction projects.
Had you already decided as a group what those 17 projects will be?
Yes. So we have, through the board, Turco and others, we have a grants committee. And we accept project applications from people or project proposals from people. They combine those into what they believe to be the highest priorities. And then we use that as the basis of our grant proposals. So those are all pre-identified projects. This grant, March 10th, was the award date, but we applied for it back in December. So it's a process. So we're looking years out in advance for project work and then funding.
So with that new grant that you received on March 10th, are there any specifics that you can tell us about now?
Yeah, one that's really important is the City of Paso Robles is having a serious problem with fires in the Salinas River bottom area caused by homeless encampments. They've done some work in there last year. They had over 200 fires in 2019 in the river bottom in the city
Wow.
of Paso Robles. So it's a life hazard problem. It's an environmental contamination problem. So we got several thousand dollars to assist Paso Robles in doing some additional planning and work in there to reduce the number of fires in the river bottom.
Turco Sems, did you have an example of?
I live on Toro Creek Road, and we were just part of a grant awarded for clearing along roadways. That's another thing that's big, is to clear in these rural areas where the trees hang over and give that more space so you can get out in a fire. Cambria is an area that has a lot of Monterey pines dying. It's an incredibly isolated community, very hard to get in and out of. And there are lots of wind patterns. So a lot of grants have been done over the last few years and probably into the coming years that we work with to help remove dead pines, to create and clear out invasive species, to really help the city look at strengthening themselves and hardening themselves against a fire. So Cambria is a great one.
I have friends who still have that brochure, was it Living with Fire, that came from your organization. I remember when they first got it, and they're in the middle of a forest. And I remember we looked around at the trees, but we thought, you know, it's almost impossible for each home in Cambria to have the defensible space.
Yes, this is Dan. Cambria, we've done a tremendous amount of work up there over the last 10 years, actually. And it is a special case. It's a rare forest, for one thing. Monterey pine is a rare species. And it's inhabited by about 4,500 people that live right in the middle of that forest. Monterey pine naturally likes fire. So it uses fire as a means to reproduce and generate more seedlings. Well, a prescribed fire in there would be a great technique to mimic what naturally would occur, but the 4,500 homes in there kind of make that complicated. So we've been doing a lot of work in trying to mimic what fire would do by manual methods. So we're removing the dead trees. We're removing some of the invasive species, French broom, Scotch broom, horrid. People need to remove it immediately. We're spending thousands of dollars removing French broom from Cambria with the intent to what we call sweep out the broom in Cambria. It's in full bloom right now in the spring.
Okay.
Incredibly invasive. And the thing about French broom is it grows where there's been disturbance along roadsides, where the roadsides have been cut. It likes that. So it grows prolifically there, incredibly flammable. And it's if you're trying to use that as an evacuation route, you have an incredibly flammable plants right along your evacuation route. But it's a years-long process to do.
Yeah. How about other communities? Turco, did you want to address what?
Well, I think a lot of communities come to us to look for special help. And they could be homeowners, you know, associations. Baywood Los Osos is one. Next to the little pygmy trees and trying to work in the area with a lot of underbrush, which, you know, maybe they don't have the big trees, but they have underbrush. But we have a lot of communities such as Barron Canyon, different homeowners groups, Nacimiento. We do a lot of work out in Nacimiento and the lakes and San Antonio. They're, of course, a remote community. There, a lot of effort is spent there. I know that we also encourage places that have a sort of concentrated people and a common interest to form fire safe focus groups. So they are individual focus groups that stand alone, but under the umbrella of the Fire Safe Council. I'm not sure how many we have now, but I know we've got at least 20 or 30. And they're all over the county. And those people each have very unique needs. So they come to us, they put together their kind of plan with assistance, and then we try to fit them into grants as the money comes down that are appropriate. We should probably speak about the color of money. Dan, maybe you can speak to this in more detail because you understand this color of money.
It's our joke. So everybody's money, like Monopoly money, has rules. So you may have money that comes from the federal government, for example. You can only use it for the following things. So those restrictions may not be what you want to do. So the classic that we've coined this term was is up on the mountaintops along Cuesta Ridge are several communication sites, microwave, radio towers, TV towers, so forth. They're incredibly vulnerable to fire. So those are on leaseholds inside the Los Padres National Forest. You can't use federal money to do any protection on federal lands. So we were getting federal grants, but we couldn't use the federal dollars to do the work there to protect those sites.
Oh, boy.
So the color of their money wouldn't let us do it. PG&E stepped forward and gave us a grant that allowed us to do that work because their color of money didn't have that same restriction. So a lot of what we do is try to find the right color money to do that particular project.
This is Issues and Ideas. I'm Carol Tangeman. In the studio with me is Dan Turner, the manager of the Fire Safe Council, and Turco Sims, who is on the board. Dan, tell me about the FireWise Cities.
FireWise Communities. Is the term, and it's a national recognition program. And we have several within this county.
Oh, good. I was hoping you'd say we had some.
We do. And the significance of this, and I think it's important, is it's a recognition the community is aware there's a problem and they're doing something about it. And that may be educating their members. That may be physically going out and doing something to mitigate the problem. So we actually have the largest FireWise community in California is in this county. The entire community of Cambria is a FireWise community. We have FireWise communities up at Lake Nacimiento, small ones like Ranchita States out behind Lopez Lake. So we have them all over the county. So what we have found is that FireWise communities recognition is assisting, not solving the problem of people getting fire insurance, which is a monstrous problem in this county and statewide. Is many of the insurance companies are trying to minimize their risk exposure. So they're only writing a certain number of policies in an area. So we find people are coming to us all the time saying, I can't get my insurance renewed. Not getting canceled, but they're just not being renewed. So if they're on the edge, so an insurance company may write 50 policies in the area. If they're on the cusp of 49, 50, 51, if they're in a FireWise community, it may assist them in getting that insurance company to reconsider renewing their policy. Some insurance companies actually give a discount if you're in a FireWise community.
How big can a FireWise community be?
So Cambria, like I mentioned, is the largest one in California today, and it's grandfathered in. So the rules change on the national level. 2,500 people is the largest FireWise community they'll allow. We wanted to do the community of Los Osos, but they said it's too large. So we're working in neighborhoods now in Los Osos to establish FireWise community at the neighborhood level.
Well, it sounds like the FireSafe Council has been operating in our county, San Luis Obispo County, for about 20 years. Turco Sems, what are some of the things that you feel have been successful and that keep you going?
And it may be just, you know, luck, but, you know, we have been spared recently major fires, devastating fires. We've had wildland fires, and they burn tens of thousands of acres, but in areas that weren't, you know, close to a lot of people living. Some of that is just luck, topographic luck, winds, weather, everything. But I think our preparedness and I think that the San Luis Obispo Fire Safe Council, and there's one in each county, we're actually known as one of the most effective. We've gotten more done. Many times other counties can't use their money in enough time. They fall outside the parameters of the grant. They come to San Luis Obispo to say, we have this grant, can you use this money in the next 6 months? And that's fast to use it. And most of the time we can, because it's organized. There are a lot of shovel-ready projects, sort of like people keeping things ready just for that situation. So I'm just proud of how effective we've been, and I hope that's been one of the reasons that San Luis Obispo County has been spared major destructive fires, this forward-looking, this preparedness that we help with.
Okay, Dan Turner, does anything come to mind for you?
Probably the thing that makes me smile the most about the Fire Safe Council is the cross-section of the stakeholders. So we really reach out to get a cross-section of the community that have concerns with this issue, from Cattlemen's Association to EcoSlow to the universities to air pollution to utility companies, the universities. We want a little cross-section of everybody, because that works two ways. One is they bring their knowledge to the table and help us craft quality solutions. But in turn, they take that education back to their constituency to let them know, what is the Fire Safe Council doing? Why are they doing this project the way they're doing it? And it's moving that information and that education across the county as quickly as we possibly can. We don't want a room full of one mindset. That's of no value. We don't need 30 people in a room with one mindset. We need 30 people in the room with 30 different views.
Which is basically what this county is like.
Correct. So the work we do is not without controversy. I mean, we every day we run into differing opinions mm-hmm. on whether we should do this or do that. So we work our way through that process. And we try to engage the best management practices, the best minds, scientists. That's why we have Cal Poly engaged. If we need a scientific opinion on something, we reach into that unbelievable depth of resources over there and find the expert on that, say, okay, this is what we're thinking about doing. What's your view on that? Or can you counsel or advise us on this best management practice? For example, Cambria, not that it's ever been controversial for anything, is controversial now. And so we have questions about what, you know, our techniques. So we've engaged, I was doing a count yesterday, in fact, we've engaged 13 forest scientists in review of what we're doing in Cambria to make sure we're doing the right thing, the right way, the right place, the right time. And even with that, it's not without differing opinions. And again, the Fire Safe Council meetings aren't without controversy. So we bring an item, throw it on the table, and we get these disparate views and they discuss them. That's a fascinating process to watch. It's not fast.
No.
Sometimes it's not even pretty, but it's good. And that, to me, I think is the most success for this Fire Safe Council, is that cross-sectional representation.
The website, Fire Safe Council.
It's fscslo.org.
Let's say we go to the website. What will we find there?
Well, you'll find events such as the announcements of the meetings, minutes for our meetings, copies of documentation. But there's a lot of reference materials there and links.
And if you're interested, you can find the maps that I discussed earlier. Those maps are there, too. Take a look at that. Matter of fact, we ask people that know their community well to look at the map that's in their community and correct anything on it and let us know, because things change. Maps aren't always perfect, but they're pretty detailed maps. I mean, they're really, they got the addresses and the water tanks and everything located, the swimming pools, the special things that a firefighter would need to know. So please check them out and let us know if there's any updates.
Dan?
Well, just a couple of things. One is to prepare yourself and your family. Is your home safe? Is your family safe? Do you have a plan? And exercise that plan and really think that plan out. Many people think, well, this is what I'll do when a fire comes. I'll get my garden hose out, or I'll do my this, or I'll do my that. Well, do you have a plan if you're not home? Furthermore, do you have a plan if you have adolescent children that are home by themselves that have no transportation when you're gone? Do you have a plan for pets? Plan for livestock, horses, when you're not home? What happens if you're not home when the fire occurs and there's an evacuation order? You're not getting back in. So have you contacted your neighbors? Do your neighbors know about these situations? So it's communities. That's the fire safe focus groups. Communities helping neighbors. That's really important. Think this through. And then lastly, if you have a cell phone, if you need to register that cell phone number with the sheriff's department, reverse 911. Because if you don't register your cell phone, if they issue an evacuation or warning on reverse 911, you won't get it.
Okay, remind us again how to do that.
So you go on the sheriff's website. It's easy to do. And you register your cell phone number to an address, your home address. So if that area is included in the reverse 911 notification, you'll get a notification on your cell phone regardless of where you are. Another benefit that I use is I also register, I have a 92-year-old mother-in-law. I register her address on my cell phone. So if there is a emergency in her neighborhood, I know about it.
Good to know.
If you have people that even live outside of the county, you can check on those counties and see if you can register your cell phone on those addresses as well. The failure of that system is it requires you to register your cell phone. It doesn't do it automatically. So go do that right now.
Well, thank you for coming in.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
That was San Luis Obispo County Fire Safe Council Manager Dan Turner and Board Member Turco Sems. You can learn more at fscslo.org. Next, the Hourglass Project is a year-old action tank focusing on forming a viable plan to create new jobs and economic development across the Central Coast. Although the pandemic has canceled planned events today that involve a new announcement for the project, the group is moving forward with unveiling new initiatives. We learn more about what's been happening behind the scenes. Here's KCBX's Greta Mart with that interview.
Well, I'm here in the KCBX studio with, may I ask you to introduce yourself, starting with you on my right?
Sure. My name is Melissa James. I'm the CEO of REACH, an organization formerly known as the Hourglass Project.
And yourself?
Hi, Greta. My name is Andrew Hackelman. I'm vice president at REACH, also formerly Hourglass Project.
Okay, got it. So remind us what the Hourglass Project now REACH is and, and what have you guys been doing?
Sure. So the Hourglass Project, now REACH, is an economic impact organization serving the central coast of California. So from Vandenberg Air Force Base to Camp Roberts. It's about 12 cities, 2 counties, and 500,000 people. And just about a year ago, it was professionally staffed with Andrew and I coming on to the team. And our charge was to develop out a vision and an action plan for economic prosperity across the central coast. So for the better part of the last 10 months, that's exactly what we've been doing.
And why the name change? What's REACH all about?
Sure. So the Hourglass Project was so named by a group of volunteers who were coming together with the goal of charting a better economic future within the context of the conversation of the Diablo closure and how that was going to impact our local economy or our regional economy. It was always meant to be a temporary name. So Hourglass Project was coined because everyone believed that time was running out and we needed to move to action. We have spent the better part of the year developing out that action plan, and the organizational name REACH is a regional economic action coalition, and our purpose is to put ideas into action for a thriving Central Coast.
Okay, got it. All right. And what's your role, Andrew?
So to act as kind of an advisor and lead on strategy development and kind of the stuff that we've been doing for the past 9-10 months now, and engaging with leaders across the Central Coast and the region that we've defined from Vandenberg Air Force Base to Camp Roberts in the north of Slo County and Monterey County, and really understanding from a community level what the opportunities are, what the challenges are, and how we can respond and make sure that post-Diablo closure that our region is able to not only mitigate those loss of high-paying jobs, but actually overcome that with a multiple increase in good-paying jobs that our residents can move into, and so that we also diversify our economy in a way that leaves us less vulnerable to changes in single large employers leaving.
It must have been a year ago that we talked, that you came in. And at that time, it was pretty San Luis Obispo County focused, but now it's kind of expanded. Tell me about why the expansion down to include Vandenberg.
So it was actually the economic footprint was charted out at the beginning, and it was done so because we were looking at the impacts of the Diablo closure, and those impacts did not stay within the county lines. Many of the workforce that's employed at Diablo reside all the way down to Lompoc up to San Miguel. And when you think about where our jobs are, where our housing is, there's a lot of flow across county and city boundaries. And so we designed this kind of geographic footprint that really is reflective of the way that commerce and the economy works.
Things are happening at Vandenberg, for instance, the creation of the Space Force. Are you planning for things happening on at Vandenberg?
Absolutely, Greta. So we've been working with local members of the community, leaders in the community, mayors, civic organizations, but also Space Force leaders. Our Congressman, Salud Carbajal, and many others on working towards creating opportunity for commercial space launch expansion at Vandenberg. And also, I should mention that the state of California is a big partner in leaning in enthusiastically to helping create this opportunity here on the Central Coast, because it has statewide implications for leadership in technology and in this industry that California needs to be able to create high-paying jobs of the future.
Mm-hmm. What are you unveiling on mid-month? Mm-hmm. What can people expect to see?
So we unveiled our Reach 2030 plan, and within that we have a goal of creating 15,000 new good-paying jobs across the Central Coast. We have four strategic priorities and six initiatives and over 20 different tactics of how we're going to achieve that. But at the really high level, the four strategic priorities are to accelerate job growth in target industries, which are ag tech, technology, aerospace, defense, and precision manufacturing, and renewable energy and clean tech. The second strategic priority is to create world-class innovation hubs, looking specifically at Vandenberg Air Force Base and the potential for commercial space expansion in Diablo Canyon and the future reuse opportunities that exist there across a range of different opportunities like renewable energy, desalination, conservation. We also have a third strategic priority focused on breaking down the barriers to job creation. So these are the underlying conditions that are necessary for a thriving economy. So housing, infrastructure, water, transportation. And then finally, the fourth strategic priority is about preparing our residents for future jobs. So it's really looking at expanding and integrating our educational opportunities here.
Very ambitious. And now, and you can't do this all by yourself. Are you having partners with this, or how are you going to make this happen?
Greta, yes, absolutely. And on the Vandenberg Commercial Space Launch Expansion Initiative, one of those partners, of course, is the state, but also the Space Force, and as well as Cal Poly. And one of the things that we're unveiling on the 16th is the signing of a memorandum of understanding between the GoBiz office. So Lenny Mendonca, the director of GoBiz, and Governor Newsom's chief economic advisor, our organization, Melissa James, the Cal Poly president, Jeff Armstrong, 30th Space Wing Commander, Colonel Tony Mastalier, and Deloitte's California region managing director, Josh Nisbet, will all be signing a visionary document that commits and aligns all of these key partners to working together to create the opportunities for a commercial space launch expansion here on the Central Coast.
What's going on with offshore wind as far as you guys are concerned, and what do you all know about that?
Well, offshore wind is a tremendous opportunity for us in this region, and it's tied to the initiatives that Melissa just described. And so We've been an energy community for the last several decades with Diablo Canyon in our backyard. And as it closes, this challenge reveals another opportunity, and that's offshore wind energy production. We have, as you know, two of the three offshore wind sites on the California coast, and we have the transmission infrastructure here, and we're just ideally suited to be part of California's sustainable energy future. And so we're working closely with the County of San Luis Obispo, as well as Congressman Salud Carbajal, on ensuring that we're doing everything we can to advocate and ensure that we have a sustainable energy future here in the Central Coast. And we believe that includes offshore wind.
Are you pretty optimistic about it'll be worked out and that some form of offshore wind will come to the Central Coast? Or is it still really up in the air?
Well, the Navy has national security concerns for ranges off the coast of our state here. But we're going to have to work and join together as a community to ensure that our perspective is understood and that we can work together to compromise and find something that works well to be able to fully realize the potential that we have. But it is going to be a challenge, and it's going to require engagement from our community and from our state and continued leadership from Congressman Salud Carbajal, who has been doing a lot of work in this area over the last couple of years.
What are some other renewable energies that you've been looking at that might be coming to the Central Coast? Is it more solar, more terrestrial wind? Is it wave? What are y'all looking at?
So it's all of the above. We see a lot of opportunity at the site at Diablo to also be a renewable energy innovation hub, to be able to have like research and development that's taking place. So the potential for offshore wind being commercialized, but then there's also testing that can be taking place in newer technologies like wave energy. We are a community that has a couple of really big solar plants. So solar is a part of the fabric of our community. But the way we're really looking at this is the state has very ambitious renewable energy goals, and they're going to need to integrate a lot more renewable energy in our state to meet those needs and those goals. And we're trying to position here on the Central Coast to be a part of that solution. We've always been an energy generating community. And as nuclear is transitioning out, we are looking at ways in which we can be integrating into the energy of the future.
In your work over the last year, have you been looking at kind of education aspects or components like workforce training? Mm-hmm. Where does that fit into the whole picture for you guys?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's one of our four broad strategic priorities as related to education. So there's a handful of layers of what that looks like. So we, across our community, we have the need for more access to four-year degrees as one example, and kind of the education ladder, if you will. So we're looking at some advocacy strategies, partnering with our community college and State University President Jeff Armstrong on what that might look like to increase capacity here across the Central Coast. But we also need more training, so apprenticeship programs and CTE programs, and how our local community colleges are partnering with industry for where the job signal demand is going to be out into the future, as well as K-12 and their ability to align college and career pathways to local jobs. So across the education spectrum, it's critical that industry and the private sector is partnering very closely with education, because at the end of the day, our goal and purpose is to see local Central Coast residents have more opportunity to economic mobility through job creation. And so if they don't have the education and training to step into those jobs, we will have not met our mark. So it's an important part of our overarching strategy.
And we need to make sure that we're providing those opportunities here locally too, because we have a aging population in the state of California, and we need to do our absolute best to provide education and training opportunities here, because we need to retain as many of our young residents as possible.
I can see if this whole new wind industry is brand new to the West Coast, and now that the technology is kind of caught up where it enables it to happen, and we're kind of at the center of it, I can really see a program at, let's say, Cuesta or Hartnell that would be an offshore wind track or whatever, mm-hmm, that you'd learn mm-hmm. how to do that. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, what else do you really want people to know at this juncture in your guys' evolution? what do you really need in terms of increasing towards your goal?
Well, I think that one of the biggest things that we need is kind of a broad understanding across the region with our private sector business leaders, our government leaders, and our civic organizations to understand and align around a set of strategic priorities that we can work together to try to achieve so that we're focusing our efforts on just a handful of things that we know will make a big difference for our region over the next decade or two in terms of good-paying job creation, but also taking care of the sustainability of our community. So investing in infrastructure, making sure that we're producing the right amount of housing and the right product type to house our workforce, and that we're maintaining resilience with water, not just in certain locations, but across our community, and that we're advancing our transportation network and high-speed internet and all the things that will make us competitive in a future economy, in a global economy.
That was KCBX's Greta Mart in conversation with Melissa James and Andrew Hackelman of REACH, formerly known as the Hourglass Project. Here's a book title for you. Wherever There's a Fight, How Runaway Slaves, Suffragists, Immigrants, Strikers, and Poets Shaped Civil Liberties in California. An exhibit based on the book is currently on display at the San Luis Obispo Library. Host Brian Reynolds talks to the authors, Elaine Ellenson and Stan Yogi.
I must admit, this is a topic very close to my heart. I was a career librarian, and librarians are often in the forefront of protecting the right to information and civil liberties in general. What I'd like to do before we actually talk about the book is ask you to each talk a little bit about yourselves briefly, you know, what you do in your day job and how you came to write the book. Elaine, let's start with you.
Sure. Brian, my life has always been sort of a combination of writing and activism. I worked for the United Farm Workers, and I was a reporter for Pacific News Service. And most recently, I worked at the American Civil Liberties Union in Northern California, where I met my co-author, Stan. And I was the communications director there. And I've always been interested in civil rights and civil liberties, and even after the book initially came out, I've continued to do that kind of work. I do research and exhibits for the National Park Service now on civil rights history, and I'm always finding things that I never knew about and I want our students and others to know about.
Yes, and I'm sure there's a trove of things that are important and not necessarily available to people. Stan, how about you?
Well, I had a slightly different path to writing this book with Elaine. I initially thought I was going to become an English professor, so I was in a PhD program in English at UC Berkeley, but I decided that was not the career path for me. So I ended up working in philanthropy for a while, working for a grant-making organization, the California Humanities Council. And from there, I worked as a fundraiser, first as a consultant, and then eventually at the American Civil Liberties Union of Northern California, which is where Elaine and I met, as she explained. I worked there for about 14 years. During that time, Elaine and I co-wrote this book. And I left about 10 years ago because I wanted to spend more time doing research and writing other books. I have since the publication of Wherever There's a Fight, which was initially published in 2009, I co-wrote a biography for younger readers about Fred Korematsu, who is one of the civil rights heroes that we write about in Wherever There's a Fight. And I will probably talk about him a little later in this program. In addition to my writing life, I'm also a nonprofit consultant, and I work with mostly small social justice organizations around the country, helping them with fundraising.
That's a sterling background. I probably have self-declared already to you all that my own background as a librarian and, I don't know, civic activist, for lack of a better word, was forged at Berkeley back in the late 60s. And I guess I never went back to sleep. I got woke in those days. That's the current term. And I'm still a big supporter of solid information for everyone, especially for people who are the underdogs of society, who often not only get ignored but abused on a daily basis. I want to ask before we get into the book per se, that's a long title, and it it's also kind of intriguing or quixotic wherever there's a fight. What's the connection between a fight and the overall theme of the book?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked, because one of the stories in our book is actually about Grapes of Wrath and the censorship of Grapes of Wrath. And your listeners may remember that phrase, wherever there's a fight, actually comes from Grapes of Wrath. It's the scene where Tom Joad is talking to Ma Joad, and she's asking where he's going to go, and he said, wherever there's a fight. And it just seemed to encompass all of the kinds of issues that we were talking about that are mentioned, as you said, in our lengthy subtitle about people fighting for their rights. And if I may take a moment just to tell you about the censorship of Grapes of Wrath, because that's one of the stories that's featured in our book, and one of the librarians who is featured in our book is Gretchen Knief, who was the chief librarian in Bakersfield in Kern County when Grapes of Wrath first came out in 1939, and she ordered 600 copies of the book and then was told that the Associated Farmers and others, including the Board of Supervisors of Kern County, didn't want her to distribute it, and they actually banned that book. And it was banned for almost a year, even though there were a lot of protests by readers in Kern County that they wanted to have the book. But Gretchen Knief, as I mentioned, she's one of our heroines because she thought of a very clever way to get around the ban, which was she took her 60 copies of Grapes of Wrath and she sent them to other counties so people in other counties could read the book.
Censorship oftentimes boomerangs or comes back on you and probably promoting interest in the book and getting people intrigued out way beyond the borders of Kern County. It's funny how stuff like that works.
You're absolutely right. I mean, the book was already on the bestseller list when it was banned, but then one of the members of the Board of Supervisors, who was also with the Associated Farmers, took a picture or had a picture of himself burning the book. And that was published in Look magazine in August 1939. And if you want to think about who else was burning books in 1939, I don't think that was very good publicity for those who wanted that book banned.
I think it's an interesting historical fact, too, that the Depression really never, the grip it had on the country never really lost its grip until we, you know, ramped up for World War II. So at the time the book was published, it was still going strong, people out of work and so forth. And so it had been in place for about 10 years, 29 to 39. Let's talk about the overall theme of the book, some of the episodes that stand out for you. Stan, how about you?
Addressing the initial question you asked us, Brian, about fights and why fight is in the title, one of the goals of our book is to really show readers that our civil rights, our civil liberties are not bestowed to us by benevolent politicians or governments. They're really the result of fights that everyday people like you and me have waged throughout our state's history so that we can enjoy rights like a freedom of speech and freedom of association and freedom from racial discrimination. So one story that sticks out to me that's relevant very much to the Central Coast is that of the World War II incarceration of Japanese Americans. And that's a central story to Wherever There's a Fight. And in San Luis Obispo, where I know you're based, there used to be a small Japan town on Higuera between South and Madonna Streets. And that Japantown was basically destroyed with the World War II incarceration of Japanese Americans. So Japanese Americans who were living in San Luis Obispo County and northern Santa Barbara County, they were initially sent to a temporary camp in Tulare in the Central Valley, and then they were transferred to a more permanent camp in Arizona called Gila River. There were very few Japanese Americans who resisted what was going on during World War II, their forced removal from their homes and their forced incarceration to these camps. And that's because most Japanese Americans at that time wanted to show that they were loyal. A handful of Japanese Americans, like Fred Korematsu, who I mentioned earlier, who resisted. And Fred Korematsu resisted going to these camps initially because he was in love with his Italian-American girlfriend. He didn't want to be separated from her. Eventually, Fred was arrested for defying the government's orders. His girlfriend broke up with him. Executive director of the American Civil Liberties in San Francisco read about Fred's arrest and visited him in jail and asked him whether he would serve as a plaintiff in a test case challenging the constitutionality of the mass incarceration of Japanese Americans. And Fred Korematsu agreed to that. His case went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, which unfortunately in 1944 ruled 6-3 against him. And Fred lived with that disappointment for decades until a researcher uncovered evidence in the National Archives in the early 1980s that government attorneys during World War II had basically lied to the Supreme Court. Those attorneys claimed that they had evidence Japanese Americans on the West Coast were sending signals to Japanese enemy ships in the Pacific Ocean when they knew that was not true. In fact, they knew the opposite was true, that there was no evidence of such espionage. And when Fred learned about this evidence of the government's misconduct, he reopened his criminal conviction or challenged his criminal conviction now 40 years later. And a federal judge in San Francisco overturned that conviction. So he's a real civil liberties hero.
Boy, I've heard of his name, and I just get goosebumps thinking about his courage and really lonely courage. I mean, probably a lot of people below the surface were interested in what he was doing or supportive of it, but that, you know, as you say, didn't dare speak out. I do need to mention, it might be in your book, that there were a bunch of very courageous Anglo families in the area. The Loomis family is one. That would take the properties that had been formerly owned by their Japanese-American friends and hold them until they were able to come back. The Akeda family was able to take advantage of that, I know, in particular. So there were some resistors, if you will, but on the other side of the ethnic fence. I want to remind everyone that this is Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we're joined by authors of a new book, Elaine Ellenson and Stan Yogi. the title of the book, and this is a tongue twister too, is Wherever There's a Fight, How Runaway Slaves, Suffragists, Immigrants, Strikers, and Poets Shaped Civil Liberties in California. I want to talk a little bit, if I may, people who are, let's call them, for lack of a better term, the underdogs. And of course, membership in that group changes from time to time. But the underdogs have to fight for justice. But it seems to me the wealthy just buy it. Is that a little too cynical, or what do you think?
Well, I think, in the stories that we uncovered, we did really uncover, from really dusty archives and letters and diaries of early Californians, some fights, as you said, of the underdog that are never really talked about in our school curriculum. And so that was one of the motivations that we had and our publisher Heyday had for bringing out these stories. As Stan said about Fred Korematsu, even earlier, somebody who really inspired us was Charlotte Brown. Most people, wherever we speak, even in San Francisco, where Charlotte Brown lived in 1863, had never heard of her. And yet she was the daughter of an enslaved man whose wife had bought his freedom in Maryland, and they came out to San Francisco. So Charlotte Brown was a young woman, young African-American woman, who was riding on the omnibus streetcar to go to a doctor's appointment, and she was told by the conductor, again, 1863, that she would have to get off because, quote, colored persons were not allowed to ride. And this was a time when, the Civil War was raging and the Emancipation Proclamation had not yet reached most slaves. And even in California, blacks could not, vote, serve on juries. And yet Charlotte Brown and her father took the Omnibus Railroad Company to court. And eventually they actually won a case that banned racial segregation on public transportation. This was in 1863.
Wow.
So, almost a century before Rosa Parks, and I'm, thrilled that, you know, all of us learn about Rosa Parks, but in California we had our own Rosa Parks, Charlotte Brown, and yet she's really an unsung heroine. So you're right that a lot of these stories are never told, and that's one reason we're very grateful to, you know, have written this book, and also to the San Luis Obispo Library for hosting the exhibit based on our book.
I guess Rosa Parks was told to sit at the back of the bus or else, and I guess Miss Brown was told to get off the bus altogether. Is that actual?
She was told to get off the bus, and she actually refused for several stops to get off the bus, and then the conductor took her by the elbow and forcibly removed her from the omnibus streetcar. And
wow.
So, you know, she was undaunted and fought back.
Good.
We're very, very inspired by her.
Good for her. I have a hunger for hearing about these heroes and learning more about their lives and their struggles. And I was watching cartoons with my granddaughters over the weekend, and I think it was one of the cable shows, but the theme of the cartoon was to take historic figures. In this case, it was Mark Twain. And he shows up as a cartoon figure with these other kids and learning about some of his egalitarian ideas and how, you know, when you're laughing, the work goes quicker. And, of course, was quite a humorist. And it was just positive without being smarmy or cloying. I was amazed and also gratified to see that there's stuff out there, even in the world of commercial media, that is telling these stories. And it's just a real comfort.
You know, that's really good to hear about the cartoons. I mean, one thing that we decided to do with the book, and, you know, and this kind of goes along with what you're just talking about, is to tell the stories about the fights for different civil rights and voting rights and freedom of the press through individual stories.
Right.
And, you know, one person I, for example, found incredibly inspiring and still do, and in this year of the centennial of women's suffrage, I have to talk about her. Her name is Selina Solomons, and she was a suffragist in San Francisco in the early 1900s. And she was unusual in that she felt that the suffrage movement was too society-led, you know, was led by these elite club women. And
right.
She felt that the working-class women, you know, had not been educated or brought into the suffrage movement. So what she did was open a lunchroom where she cooked and served lunch at Union Square in San Francisco to the waitresses and the shop girls and the laundresses and the telephone operators. And we actually found the menu of her Votes for Women lunchroom in Bancroft Library, which was quite a thrill. And then she organized the women to, she said, we hope that the women who come to eat stay to organize for the vote. And they did. And she took them precinct walking. She took them to a demonstration at City Hall. And, you know, eventually, actually, California won the vote for women through efforts like those of Selina Solomons in 1911, which was almost a full decade before the national 19th Amendment granted women the right to vote. So,
what was the era? What was the era in which she was doing that? Her activism. What time frame, roughly?
Was active from like the early 1900s until 1911.
Okay. Could I ask you to discuss from your own vantage point perhaps a big issue that we haven't covered or something that we didn't get right or possibly something that really surprised you and stayed with you in the researching and the writing of the book?
So one thing I didn't really know prior to researching and writing Wherever There's a Fight was that there was basically genocide of Native people in California from the beginning of statehood. I mean, there were government programs basically to exterminate Native people. So that was a shock to me.
Right. I did a recent interview with actually a person from NPR on the Fremonts, John C. and his wife, and he was involved in some of that himself. Anyway, it was pretty ugly and pretty sad part of our history.
Mm-hmm. Yes, John Fremont, you know, definitely left a trail of blood behind his exploits. And the irony is that his wife, Jessie Benton Fremont, whom I've actually done research on and an exhibit on for the National Park Service, became an abolitionist. And she led an abolitionist salon during the Civil War in San Francisco, right out at the Presidio. So there's a lot of contradictions in our history.
Elaine and Stan, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. This has been Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today, we were joined by Elaine Ellenson and Stan Yogi, authors of a new book on civil liberties in California entitled Wherever There's a Fight, How Runaway Slaves, Suffragists, Immigrants, Strikers, and Poets Shaped Civil Liberties in California. Could we get that website one more time?
It's wherevertheresafight, all one word, .com.
That was host Brian Reynolds in conversation with Elaine Ellenson and Stan Yogi, co-authors of Wherever There's a Fight. There's an exhibit named after the book at the San Luis Obispo Library. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments at kcbx.org.